Hey, Atlanta, winter is the perfect time to start planning for your healthy, pest-controlled spring lawn with True Green, America's number one lawn care company. True Green's science-based approach and year-round local expertise will help your lawn be thick and weed-free, guaranteed. Go to truegreen.com/RD to save 50% on your first service. Just call 1-877-216-0482 or go to truegreen.com/RD today and get a lawn to be proud of.
Hello and welcome to Quality of Life Radio, hosted by Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Welcome, everybody. We first met Chantal Jovin on Big Blend Radio with her book, The Boy with a Bamboo Heart, the story of a street orphan who built a charity. And today we're excited to welcome her back, this time on our Quality of Life show. She's going to be talking about her brand new book. It's out now. It is called Love Without Martinis, How Couples Build Healthy Relationships in Recovery, based on real stories. Her real stories in there, and so are some others. So go to ChantalJovin.com, and that's Chantal, C-H-A-N-T-A-L, and J-A-U-V-I-N.com is the website to go to, and you can get the links for all her books. So welcome back, Chantal. How are you?
Hello. It's wonderful to be back. I am doing very well.
Good. Now, did I pronounce your last name, and did I spell everything correctly? Because, you know, I could get different. You know, I give people new names all the time.
Well, I like the one you gave me, and you have it right. It is Chantal Jovin, and the spelling Jovin is perfect.
See, cool. We're going to have to get there, because I know we have French-Canadian blood in us. So I know the mm-hmm. Jovin, right? That's more French, right, in your last name.
Mm-hmm. It is. I come from Ottawa in Canada, and I was brought up speaking French, studying in French. So that is really my mother tongue. Hear my French accent here and there when we talk. That TH isn't always my friend.
Oh, well, you know, hey, listen, Nancy and I, we have to go to Canada. And you, by the way, thank you for introducing us to Lee Brovedani. She's now mm-hmm. a Big Blend expert on our shows all the time, talking about trust. And she's been filling us with all kinds of things to watch Canadian, because we've gotten into Canadian humor quite a bit. We love British TV, British, you know, comedy. I know this is really what you came on the show to talk about, but now Canadian. And now that she was just on our show yesterday, so I'm just like, we have to go to Canada, Nancy, when those borders open
Absolutely.
Up for us.
Yeah,
that's it.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to going back to Canada myself. So, yes, Lee is a wonderful friend, and I love her sense of humor. So it's great that you've connected.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely. That's awesome that, you know, you guys connected us and everything. But the last time you were on our show, believe it or not, was actually our happy hour show. And we asked you the happy hour question about, you know, who would you spend happy hour with? What are you going to drink? Where are you going? And now I'm going... Now her new book is Love Without Martinis and talking about recovery. And I'm like, well, oopsie, I put you on the wrong show at the beginning. You know what I mean? It's like, okay. So, you know,
we still have happy hour. I mean, happy hour is about having fun and sharing with friends. And I still enjoy my glass of wine. And my husband loves Gingerino, which is a beverage that he discovered in Italy. It tastes like Campari, but without alcohol. So that's our beverage of choice for our happy hour. And we usually have it with salty snacks, preferably cheese. And that must be from my French heritage.
There you go. There you go. Because I remember it was wine. And that's the interesting thing. You know, we'll get into the book, because I know this is, you know, really a unique book. We've done a lot of shows on addiction and recovery of all kinds. I think it's all related, but I don't think we've ever seen anybody write a book about a couple going through the recovery process. And I think this is something that, you know, no matter what kind of addiction, your book can be useful for. But that is one of those things about what happens to the other one. And, you know, one's going through recovery and then, oh, sorry, now that's it. No drinking for you. No wine time for you. But now you're saying that is possible. And it might be one of the first things people say, well, I don't want to go through your recovery process. I don't want to give up my happy hour. Then you have to start wondering about that. So it's kind of an
interesting. You do.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's amazing that you can have happy hour together.
Well, it is very much a process. And I have to be honest, for the first year and a half when my husband came home after treatment, because he did go to a residential treatment for 28 days, there certainly was no happy hour and there was no alcohol in our home. But, you know, that's a process. That was way too early. And there's a difference between sobriety and recovery. And I think the early days, we're really talking about sobriety, not having the alcohol. And as time goes by, you maintain your sobriety, but you also enter recovery. And when you develop your recovery, well, you're going to create your community. And you can't live in isolation. I mean, addiction is all about isolation. Recovery is about connection. And the world around us doesn't change because we stop drinking. And so in our particular relationship, I am in recovery, but I am not in sobriety because I don't have a substance use disorder. I mean, you know, addiction to alcohol is a disease. And so I don't have that, but my husband does. So, yes, that was obviously the genesis of writing this book was when Bill came home from treatment. I had no idea what to expect. I really didn't know very much about addiction. And I had to educate myself. I had to learn a lot. And there are many wonderful resources out there. There are experts. There are fellowships. But what I didn't find was a book that talked about the couple. How does the couple come together again? I mean, you have to rebuild your trust. You have to learn to communicate. You have a lot of baggage to heal. And that's all obviously very serious, but you also need to still have fun. I mean, one of the big questions we had, which is relevant to what you do, is when can we take our first trip together? I wasn't sure. As you know, we're avid cyclists and we love to cycle in the French countryside and the Italian countryside, which are rather known for their wine country.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So those are all very serious topics and conversations you need to be able to have. And I believe that we, personally anyway, I look to others and look to storytelling and see how others have gone through what I've gone through to find the way. And when I looked to other couples to see how they had navigated the early sobriety in particular, I didn't find anything. So I guess this is the case of writing the book I wanted to read.
Well, I think that's important because storytelling is how we take things in. I think it's the best tool for education is stories. I mean, that's why movies work and documentaries and books are fantastic, especially now that you can start getting them an audiobook. And, you know, they really help when it's a story because you can also just jump in and identify. And you're an amazing writer. I know, you know, both books that we've got, it's really, you're really good at it. And so when you think about also all these people coming together and having, you know, you and your relationship with your husband, this all started, I mean, this was the beginning process of you guys really settling in together to have that discovery of Bill, what you know, his disease and going, okay, what am I going to do? Because sometimes people would walk away instead of stay together.
Absolutely. And the book is storytelling, but it's not just our story. It's the story of six different couples, and they are all different from one another. There are couples, for example, Dave and Leslie, they were married almost 30 years, and Dave had problems with, or really began struggling with his addiction after retirement. So they had a whole lifetime of living together and shared experiences. So their path was very different than, as you mentioned, Bill and I. We had just come together and we were not engaged. We wanted to have this life together, but yet all of a sudden our life was turned upside down when I realized that he was struggling with a substance use disorder. And so that's, I think, the beauty of what you're saying about storytelling is that I like to think of it as we get to practice without getting hurt. We get to see how other people have walked the walk and what has worked for them. And then we can try it on and see if it works for us. And there are two couples in the book where there are reoccurrences. For example, Tim and Chuck, unfortunately, Tim had two instances of relapses. And so there are all these stories for the reader to learn from, not just our particular story.
You know, my uncle Bud, whenever I hear the word martini, I just automatically think of my uncle Bud because I stayed with my aunt and uncle for a little bit, and he made martinis as soon as he got home from work, and the rule was do not talk to Uncle Bud until he has made his martini. And it was this big process, and he had this glass swivel stick that he used in this big pitcher of stuff he was mixing. And it took him like 10 to 15 minutes to make these martinis. And it was like this whole ritual. And so I was fascinated by it because I was like, what the heck? You know, I was just a little kid. And I'm like, well, what is it? You know, are you going to come out with chocolate chip cookies later or what? Because it was such a big ritual. And you really could not talk to him until he had his martini. And then it was okay. And I remember my parents were like, they really didn't like him. But I just remember that glass swizzle stick. And then, you know, when I got a little older, it's like, do you want to lick the swizzle stick? Kind of thing. You know, and my Aunt Mona, his wife, she was so fastidious about everything. And it was funny to me when, as an older person looking back, wondering how it is someone like her could live the way she was, because she sort of made it easy for him to be an alcoholic. Later on, we found out that he really was, really had a few car accidents and things happened. And, I just remember that whole like 15 to 20 minute procedure of making the martinis. Like, it was like he was in church or something. It was odd.
It is a ritual. I mean, you raised some really interesting topics there, because one, it is a family disease. We all get affected when someone in our family struggles with addiction. And I now believe that it is somewhat easier because we are talking about it. We have the celebrities who are opening up the conversation. We're on the radio talking about it. And so now people are more aware of the fact that people struggle with alcohol. You know, when I think back when my parents were entertaining and the parties they used to have. Being French, we had a lot of parties in our home. There was a lot of food. Mm-hmm. There was wine. There was dancing. There was singing. And we didn't talk a lot about what happened. And it's only now that we're a little bit older and that as a society we talk about addiction that we realize that we had a lot of, oh, well, that uncle was, he was always a little happier. Or that aunt, oh, she liked, I remember my great uncle, he would say, oh, my aunt, she liked the sauce. And we had all this language that we used
that made it fun.
Not really talk about it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And what I love about these couples in the book is that they were willing to tell their stories. So the six couples, their names are their names, their families, their jobs, their arguments. It is in storytelling form. So you hear the arguments, you hear the pain. And I have so much respect for them because it is not, their stories are not in any way embellished or changed so that they cannot be recognized. And that is a huge commentary on first of all, their strength, but also that as a society, we're now able to have those conversations. Mm. And if aside from helping the couples, what I hope is that we take away the stigma. You know, I am an ovarian cancer survivor. I don't have shame in talking about that. It was a disease. I'm fortunate I had great care. And today I'm able to go cycle and like you, travel. And I can talk about that openly. And I hope that this book will open some conversations among couples and among friends to discuss it, not to just talk about, oh, that person is like, oh, that's our happier friend, you know, which is all code language.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's really important because, I mean, things like getting a colonoscopy, you know, that was a big hush-hush back in the day, you know. And alcoholism and drug addiction, I mean, right now our country is really this opioid addiction and what's happening, or even mental health, PTSD, all of these things were just swept under the rug like you're talking about, and we never heal from them. And when things are swept under the rug, it's like when the cat's away, the mice will play. They start to breed those things under the rug. And one day, it's all going to come out. It does come out in the wash. And at that time, sometimes it's too late. We do lose people to suicide from, you know, addictions. And people do change. And there's a reason why it gets a hold of them. And there's a reason why. And it's getting back and doing therapy and the recovery process, which I think is important. But I love that you're talking about a couple from what I was reading, too, in your book, that this is actually something to read even if you don't have an addiction or a disease, just on how this communication can work and how it can actually make your life better as a couple. Because I think being in a relationship, it sounds all glorious for the first 6 months, and then after the honeymoon, things start to drag. You know what I mean? But it's really this big, and it's like running a business together. I mean, it really is. It's like a whole thing. You have to have your own relationship with yourself, and then you have a relationship with your partner. You have a relationship with your coworkers. I mean, it's a separate relationship, but it's a really big one to have. And doing it with some help,
right? And
it's huge. It's huge.
And what came of writing is such a journey. I began this book with the intent of writing the stories of different couples. And that took a time to find people that were willing to talk. And also, I wanted to interview each partner separately, and both of them had to be willing to go to the interview process separately. And then I wrote their stories jointly. And so that took a while to get two people who were both had that same willingness to share publicly their story. But when that was all said and done, and I found all the couples and I wrote all the stories, I decided that because I'm not an expert in the field, it would be great if I could have an introduction written by an expert. And the expert could guide the readers with some, you know, comments beforehand so that when they read the stories, they could see some themes. And so I approached Dr. Jeremy Frank, who is a therapist in the Philadelphia area. He's been doing this over 25 years, and he wrote the introduction. And as I was putting it together, I realized that I had done, of course, a lot of research before I started the process to learn more about couples and learn more about the family disease. And so I had all this research, and I had all my stories, and then I had Dr. Frank's introduction, and then there were all these like red flags, you know, when you travel and all of a sudden there's like these big red flags waving of, here are habits that these couples engaged in without really being aware of it, but they have recovered their relationship. And here's Dr. Jeremy Frank with his 25 years of experience saying, here are what couples do that helps them rebuild their relationship in his experience. And so we created this ascent approach, which are six practices to guide couples. So I think that's what you're saying. These practices are there to nurture a couple. And although we wrote them specifically with an eye to helping couples in recovery from addiction to alcohol, I think that the wisdom there can be used in certainly many other situations.
Mm. And I think, too, you know, books like this also help the entire family. Like you're saying, it's a family thing. And
it
it's
is.
A family affair. It really is. Mm-hmm. It's like, so, you know, if you may be looking at your parents going through it. It could be your sister and her husband, or, you know, it could be anyone. And it's a good thing to even understand, because I've dated, he's now passed away, and he was a big person in our lives and in mm-hmm. my life, obviously. And he was in the band that we were in together. Never date the bass player, but just kidding. But
or the drummer.
Anyway, it was a sudden thing, but I always wonder if his past addictions led up to suddenly getting this. He had a blood clot. He was in the shower. He had the flu, taking a shower, and the blood clot happened. He fell down and died. And it's still weird to me. I still have a really hard time actually even believing it. But then I think all these things that happen to your body from what you put your body through when you overdo something, you know, it was drugs and alcohol, and he would change. He would be a completely different person. Sometimes he was more fun, you know, and that's something interesting too with couples. Like sometimes your partner is more fun when they're drinking, and then just when you think you're having so much fun, it can skid around the corner and become absolutely not fun at all. And I think that's another thing that's so important is, you know, you walk away from people a lot of times. That's why I was, you know, impressed with you starting your relationship that way and having to make those decisions to stay and go through recovery. Like that's love and dedication, because, you know, like
well,
you're saying, there are relapses.
There's a lot of resentment too.
Anger
you
too.
Feel what you're talking about is, and it's very confusing, you know, because I think early on in a relationship, you don't know. So who is the real, in my case, his name, my husband's name is Bill. Who is the real Bill? The Bill after some wine, or the Bill in sobriety?
Right.
And also Bill had to get to know himself again without the substance. And we're talking about the fun of obviously the drinking. We have to remember that recovery is a lot of fun too. I mean, we have the best time now together, and I don't have the resentment, and I don't have the doubt of is he being honest with me? Who am I communicating with? I know now, because fortunately in my case, we've now celebrated 12 years of his sobriety and our recovery.
Awesome.
And he hasn't relapsed. And recovery, people think that it becomes like, oh, it's boring. We travel, we've traveled all over the world. As you know, we're avid cyclists. And we host murder mystery parties in our home that are just a riot.
Cool.
You know, we support the arts, so we're often doing some fundraisers for dance troupes in Philadelphia. I mean, our life is so full, it's actually a lot busier and a lot more fun now because, first of all, there's accountability, there's trust, and most of all, there's communication. And so with that as a basis, it doesn't even come close to comparing to, you know, the fun from an evening where Bill was drinking and he might have been a little bit less inhibited. But that was so momentary, as you've just explained. What followed was, you know, very painful. Now you don't have that.
That's awesome.
Do you think you have to delve deep and find the cause of the addiction, why the person feels the need, and heal that first, or can you just heal the addiction?
That's a very interesting question, and there are many ways to look at it. This is my personal view, is that in recovery, if you're in a relationship, there really are three entities. There's my husband, and he needs to do his own soul work, his own recovery with a therapist. And I need, or a support group or a spiritual guide. There are many ways to do your healing. Mm. I have to do my own healing. And then our relationship has to do healing. So there are really three components. But when we think of it as a disease, there is different people will have different ways to heal. And as you know, particularly today, and we're talking in the context of the pandemic, people often are suffering from cross addiction or various mental health issues. So it's a very complex.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that each partner has to heal individually. And for some people, they may be able to understand what is the disconnect that they're trying to fill with the substance. Others may not. That is really for the individual and their support team to, you know, to figure out. What I think is key is that recovery is about connection. And if you can create connection, even as you heal what other traumas in your life, you will be progressing in your recovery because you're creating a reason for you to show up here and now in your sobriety. And that is so key.
It's about the present moment, you know, like Eckhart Tolle, you know, it's about living in the now. And what do you want of the now, you know, and being aware. And, you know, I always watch, you know, with musicians and artists and writers, too,
wow.
you know, the arts. Addiction has been a huge part in the arts. And, it, you know, it's from the old past. Like, even now we interview all these musicians, these rockers, and, you know, they're having green smoothies for breakfast now instead of a beer. You know, things have changed because it's also the culture you're talking about has changed a bit. But I think also your book is so timely right now because – I wonder about how addiction may have escalated over the year of the pandemic, the year plus, right, of the pandemic, of people being stuck at home, how now people are going to find out about addictions. You know, you can't really be quiet about them anymore. You're in the same house 24/7 together. It's going to creep up. I know that alcohol sales went through the roof during the pandemic.
As I'm promoting, the book just launched 3 weeks ago, so it's a very new book at this point. So thank you for having me on to talk about it. And because of the pandemic, obviously we're not able to have book signing events as we normally would. So what we're doing is an outreach to different treatment centers and therapists and that to make them aware of the book so they can recommend it to their patients and have it as a resource. But what I'm hearing from the various treatment centers is that, one, they're usually the first step when you go to treatment is detox. And so the larger treatment centers have detox beds. Their detox beds are – there are waiting lines for them right now. And when patients come in to detox, and this is the same number I'm hearing everywhere, is that – 30% of the people that are coming and being admitted to detox have such complicated health issues now that they often have to be hospitalized before they can enter treatment. And that is extremely high. It used to be, they said, more around 8%, sometimes 12%, depending on the treatment center. But now it's consistently around 30%. So just think of that. People are coming for their substance use disorder, but they have such complicated health issues that they can't even begin the treatment for the substance use. They have to have treatment for liver, for, you know, for the heart conditions, for all sorts of other conditions, mental health issues. So, yes, there is a pandemic, and I think that we do not yet have an understanding of what is happening in the homes of people. I mean, it's very difficult time for so many people, and you know, alcohol is readily available.
And to work together, you know, recovery wise, and I love what you're saying. Khalil Gibran had a beautiful quote about the relationship. Actually, a chapter in The Prophet talks about relationships, and it was exactly what you were saying. You have the relationship together, and you have your separate relationships with yourself. And it's the same thing as recovery, like you're saying, it's recovery together and then recovery on your own, each of you, and with support, obviously. But it's
And I love this quote about recovery. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to interject that the definition of really recovery is becoming a person that's increasingly capable of functioning in a healthy relationship. And what we're talking about here is that it's a continuum. It's not a question of, oh, you know, you drink, you stop drinking, and then a few months later you show up in your relationship and everything is fine. It is a continuum. It is a journey.
And that's how life is. I mean, that's the difference between immediate success and living excellence, you know, and just continuing with that, with your life. You know, it's important. So I think now that a lot of people are going to be clamoring, you know, to get help. And definitely get your book. That is something that is absolutely important. And I'm glad about the Ascent approach, too, that gives something for people to work with. One thing, too, that I know with addiction is sometimes there's a lot of triggers, obviously, for relapse, right? And that can happen at any time. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, pick yourself up and get back on. A friend of ours is a probation officer, and she's seen a lot of the crimes that women, especially for women, she's seen everything, things we don't want to know about. And she says that she's trying to create programs. She's retired from it now. She runs a bed and breakfast. She's still, you know, taking care of people. But her thing is recovery for misdemeanors, you know, whether it's pot or alcohol, they did something, and especially for women, that need to have some form of recovery. And the system, if they fall back, and even, you know, there's the homelessness programs, these programs where they go, you know, it's like, oh, if you fall down, you know, during your recovery program, you're kicked out of all these programs. It's kind of like a gun to your head, and that's not really motivating. You know, it's not really a place of, okay, I can get better. Relapses happen, and I think that's something also for people to deal with and understand, because triggers happen. And I think that's what's so scary about this last year of the pandemic. There's triggers, there's irritants. I know, like, Russell Brand, the comedian and actor, has done a lot about addiction and talking about transcendental meditation, and everyone's got their own thing. But having to have some place where you can get to the core and not allow, like you're saying, life continues on. Life doesn't know what you're dealing with. You're going to have to deal with life in a different way. I think that relapse is such a really big thing, and it's really sad our system doesn't acknowledge that in so many ways.
Well, and we have to take the shame out of it. You know, we don't shame people for having other diseases. And so we shouldn't shame people because they have a substance use disorder. I think that's really important. And also, I think today there are more pathways to recovery. It used to be that, you know, basically you had AA fellowship, which is a fabulous fellowship. It has helped millions of people. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, today there are options for people who have, you know, they don't connect with that particular philosophy. There's smart recovery. There's medically assisted recovery. But when it comes to relapse, the recovery you had prior to your relapse, it hasn't gone away. And the longer you have been in sobriety, you know, the quicker typically people are able to get back into their recovery. And the learnings and the healing that they have done, it doesn't disappear. And what you're speaking to are systems that are punishing people for relapse. And that is, to me, not understanding the nature of a disease.
Right.
You know, if I have cancer that shows up tomorrow because I had ovarian cancer, it's a cross cancer with, you know, gum cancer. If I had gum cancer discovered today by my dentist, they wouldn't say to me, oh, you know, you're bad and you're not going to get the treatment you need. And so we shouldn't do that with substance use disorder.
I love that you're saying this, because I just think it's a serious issue, and not just in this country, around the world. The other thing I wanted to ask you, because I know you cycle a lot and you guys do these grand adventures, and I've been following you on social media until I got hacked off of Facebook and all that, but I'm back. It was really cool to follow your adventures, and now I get to follow them again. But you guys actually getting into the planning mode, isn't that like really fun? organize these adventures and then go out and know that the unexpected always happens when you travel, but also you guys are always in fresh air. That's the first question. Let's get into the planning and actually how you've changed your lives in that way. But also, does Mother Nature help with recovery, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I have no hesitation. Don't need to even think about that. Absolutely, it helps. And fortunately, both for my husband and I, we both love nature. And the cycling, as you say, there's a lot of serendipity. And just to give some context for your listeners, my husband and I will cycle for 6 to 7 weeks. We love to do it in the French countryside. And typically we have the booking of our first night and of our last night. And in between, we have a general idea, but more often than not, it doesn't work out that way because we really just, it's our time to live in the moment and see how the universe converges, you know, with us. And so we've gone to different cities. We've stayed longer in some places. But nature is a key. And I'm going to tie it back to the ascent approach. The reason that we call it the ascent approach is it stands for the six practices, so they're easy to remember. And the N is nurture your spirituality. And for Bill and I, it is nature. We're spiritual, not particularly religious, and it's that communion with nature. That's where we connect with what I personally call, you know, the collective wisdom. And we, in this last year, because of the pandemic and not being able to just travel impromptu, we've turned to hiking. And so we've dusted off our hiking boots, and we have done a lot of hikes in Maine, in Pennsylvania, and now we're talking to you from Asheville, North Carolina, and tomorrow we are going to go discover here some of the trails. But nature is also, for me, it brings me inner peace and tranquility. And in a couple, I think that's really important because when we argue, often it's because we're being reactionary to one another.
Absolutely.
And when we are calm, we are able to just break that chain reaction. We can take that deep breath. And that space we open up is what allows us to actually be mindful. And that's in that moment I can say, oh, I am feeling really perhaps scared and I'm reacting to Bill because I'm scared about something. Mm-hmm. And how do I get that pause? I get that pause by spending time in nature where everything for me slows down and I can reflect and I can become more self-aware. So yes, we're still within the confines of the pandemic. Sometimes it's just a 1 hour hike in Wishahickon in Philadelphia, but we do that. And let me tell you, the minute we can get on our bikes and in France, we are there.
That's awesome. And by the way, Asheville is one of our favorite places. We're going back there. I'm very excited. We'll be there in the fall. But the Smoky Mountains, the Blue Ridge Parkway, and it's a very bike-centric town. They're really into cycling. And, you know, we belong to a Facebook group called Just Bike Racks. It's crazy because we don't cycle. I think if you put Nancy and I, either one of us on a bike, we'll fall off. Are you kidding me? But
they
we
have
great tandem
bikes. Tricycles nowadays.
That's our
style.
But I'll tell you what, we photograph bike racks across the country as we're traveling just for this Facebook group because it shows off a town that cares about cyclists and quality of life and health is cycling. And but Asheville, if you get a chance, go to the Arboretum. They have some beautiful trails out there and just highly recommend the Arboretum if you get a chance while you're there. But I love that you talk about nature and nurture. I think that's really important to get that freedom and actually having those. There's excitement in doing things together and kind of coming back to the table. And you talk about anger. I think there is a lot of anger, you know, with all of it, because there's also anger. I mean, I know what it's like just giving up coffee. I get crabby, you know, getting rid of sugar out of your body. We all get crabby. They're crabbing you on all sides. And so to have a place, how the communication part for a couple, do you learn things to be able to communicate better so that it's you know, this is where I'm like, without interrupting or getting angry, do you get to a place? I mean, and arguments are normal and natural, but getting to a place where you can get past the anger zone, like you're, you know, because it's there with all of this.
Absolutely, and we are human. We can't just say, oh, because we're in recovery, we don't feel certain emotions anymore. I mean, we have to feel the whole rainbow of emotions. That's what also makes our lives rich. And sometimes we are angry with cause. It's how we react to our anger that is the issue, not the fact that we have anger. But yes, again, going back to the ascent model, personally, it's the A that was the greatest learning from interviewing all of these couples. And the A stands for assess your readiness to change. And in our early sobriety, I had a need, particularly because Bill and I were new in our relationship, for Bill to share openly about, you know, his growing up and about his first family. I wanted him to entrust me with intimate thoughts and perspective, because I felt that that would be a way that I would know that he was 2 feet into our relationship. And when he was unable to do that, I perceived it as not unable, but unwilling. And that, as you can imagine, became the cause of a lot of arguments. And I wish I'd had this model, because if I had learned that what was going on is actually Bill wasn't ready, and he couldn't share this with me because he still didn't know how to process it himself. He was processing these emotions for the first time without his glass of wine, without his cognac. And so he didn't know. He was in uncharted territory. So if he didn't know, how could he start communicating with me? And in the ascent model with this assess your readiness to change, we use a good old-fashioned traffic light, you know, and he was red on talking to me about some of these issues that I wanted him to talk about. And no matter how much I would nag him, it wouldn't help. And so our work as a couple was to identify areas where, you know, he was green and I was green, meaning that we were both able and willing to discuss. And there were plenty of other topics, but you become fixated on one topic, and that's not helpful. You have to wait till your partner is ready. I believe that there are lots of techniques out there, as you know, for couples to improve their communication. I think what's important is to have the willingness and the understanding that in recovery, it does take actually much longer. And I didn't realize that. When you and I did our interview, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, Bill and I were still in a very hot spot of our relationship.
Wow.
And today we're having a great relationship, and I no longer have those doubts. But to put it in perspective, at that point he was already 4 years sober, and we were still struggling with our relationship. And I think that's one of the key learnings for couples, is that recovery takes time. And it doesn't have to necessarily take that long, but we didn't have enough guidance to move through some of our issues faster.
Having help is key, and getting the correct help. You don't necessarily go to the person next door all the time. You know what I mean? It's sometimes you've got to reach beyond. You've got to have the right people. And is that part of also hard, to get the right people on your side?
I think you're saying something that's so important. We had a lot of help. We had therapists, we had fellowships, and I certainly, my best friend was extremely supportive. But yes, there are, because we live, you know, in a complex world now, the issues we face, the trauma that we're healing, sometimes is very specific, and we do need to identify the people who can help us best. And that's what is so exciting about recovery today, is that there are many ways, you know, before there weren't that many. And so, yes, I agree with you. You have to have the right people. And sometimes you have to learn about boundaries. And some people are not necessarily the people that can help you with that aspect of your life. And that's okay. You can still have a best friend that doesn't understand recovery. It's just that maybe she's not the person you ask about those questions.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it's, I know you're an attorney too, so it's like, you know, you wouldn't go to a doctor asking attorney questions. You know, that's a thing. And you're absolutely right on that. In closing, I do want to ask, and I don't know if Nancy has more questions too, but I wanted to touch on the fact of getting into recovery, because that's to me probably one of the hardest steps is that. I mean, Bill turning around and going into, you know, recovery and going through the detox, getting someone there, isn't that one of the hardest steps?
Absolutely. It is very, mm-hmm. It's a very difficult step. Often it's because you have to break through the denial. And as you read the stories of the couples, you'll see that sometimes the person who's in denial is the partner also, because mm-hmm. we love the person we are with. And sometimes we don't want to see that the cause of what is happening in our lives is actually the substance use. And in the case of Dave and Leslie, I mean, she thought he had Alzheimer's. She thought he had back issues. I mean, you name it. The denial was very strong. And so that sometimes is the family member that struggles with acknowledging that the person they love has a substance use disorder. And again, there's so many ways now. You can start by going to an AA meeting. You can start by going to a private counselor. You can certainly go to a treatment center. Today they have outpatient services. There's a Smart Recovery. I don't know if you're familiar with She Recovers, a huge women's movement that is there for people in recovery from various addictions. So it's not a, you know, you have one try, and if it doesn't work, you're out. It can be a process. But the first step, but it's like anything. You say you stopped taking coffee. Well, that first morning when you're not having the coffee, you struggle with it. And in our culture, sometimes we don't want to go through the struggling phase, and it's okay to struggle. Because that's the first step. The first step to change is discomfort. And yes. So
struggle
taking that first step is the hardest.
Struggle is good. Struggle is good for all of us to have in our lives on all levels.
I think addiction comes from already not wanting to face certain things or struggle with certain things. It's wanting to cover up. This doesn't feel so good, so I'll just have a drink or whatever your addiction happens to be. It's to avoid that feeling of struggle. You know, so it's
Certainly for many people, that is the substance is sort of a crutch. But we have to also recognize that it is a manifold disease, in that I can have wine. And my brain will process the alcohol differently than my husband's brain will.
Okay.
I can put the wine down and I can just let it be. People who have alcohol substance disorders, their brain chemically will process the alcohol differently. And so that is why the relapses are so tremendous, because it's not a matter of, I just had one glass of wine, that was a mistake. Is that the brain will then want more alcohol. And I don't know if you know this, one of the areas where people relapse is that they get into fitness and they go to a gym, and a lot of the gyms pre-pandemic would provide mouthwash. And the mouthwash has alcohol in it. And people start, you know, using mouthwash unaware that they were triggering their brain. And then they end up relapsing.
Wow.
So
wow.
There are many, it's a complex disease.
It's not just a stressful
it's not
day.
Just a,
yeah.
Wow.
No, exactly. And that's one case. There are, I'm no purport to be an expert and say that this is always the case. But what I'm saying is that someone who has a substance use disorder will process the alcohol differently than someone else. And that is where we are learning that it's not a moral failing, that there is a disease there. And that's, the doctors have recognized that. There's research on that.
So alcohol,
but you can certainly also evolve that in that if you abuse alcohol for long periods of time, then of course your brain changes. We all know that. And so people who overdrink or drink to excess for many years then also can develop a substance use disorder. And that comes from, you know, having used so much.
So when you're talking about mouthwash, I mean, why is the alcohol in there? Is that really is it to make you come back and have some more?
No.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a mouthwash maker, but I think one of the, when you talk about support, for example, when the whole education process, when my husband went away to treatment, I began to learn about addiction. And one of the things that I had to do is make sure that certainly for the first few days and first months that he was home, that there was no alcohol in the products. And mouthwash is one. But if you look, there are many products that we have that have alcohol. You know, we notified his dentists and his other doctors that weren't treating him, because you can, if he has alcohol, his body will process it differently, and then he will crave the alcohol. Whereas if you and I use a regular mouthwash, that doesn't lead us, it doesn't affect the chemical balance in our brains.
Yeah.
Why it's in the mouthwash, that you'll have to have another guest.
It's a disinfectant.
For that one to answer the question.
It's part of a disinfectant. I know. It's like then you get pulled over by a cop, and it's like, oopsie, I cleaned my teeth today. But no, but it is interesting too, because it is in a lot of products. But it's a big deal, because it's also part of your DNA too, because it is something that passes down from families too. And you may not realize it, and next thing you know, you are right in the heart of it all, in that whirlwind of living as an addict and not even realizing it half of the time that you are. And that's the other thing. A lot of times, you know, addicts don't know that they're being an addict until it's too late. And that's why I think it's so good to have this conversation. It's good that you're doing it for couples, because I think that's a really difficult process. But you've got to remember, you fell in love for a reason. And then that comes up to, oh my gosh, well, was it, you know, sober or not sober, you know? You know, so that's that whole thing. And then you recreate a life together. We've done shows, well, with one lady, or two, a couple ladies who became addicts of everything, pretty much, drugs, alcohol, all of it. And were also sold in, almost like human trafficking from their own parents in this country, just living in the wrong side of town. And that's where they were born and raised. And at a very young age, being used as prostitutes for sex, you started at a young age, and really traumatic stuff, and really hardcore interviews to do. Just, you don't want to hear those stories, but they're out there and they're very real. And one lady actually got the key to her town. They have a day named after her. She was in prison so much for her addictions and what she did through theft and all kinds of stuff to survive. And she turned it around, and now she goes and speaks to prisons, to women in prison, and explains that you can get past these addictions. You can do it. She was raised into it. And sometimes those addictions come from those really serious things. And you could be a young couple that, you know, real young. You know, we've got to look at relationships that are starting even in their teen years, because it happens.
And what you were talking about earlier, you know, there's sometimes it starts and it's not it's not an intention. It's like, say, oh, have a sip of this, try this. And when you read the story of Nadia and Luke, Luke started drinking, having, you know, an odd beer with his father very young when they would go fishing, just the two of them. So it can be a very traumatic experience, but sometimes it's also just very much a social context. Mm-hmm. And, you know, father and son, they're going out fishing on Sundays. There's always beer in the canoe. And over time, you know, you're a young boy, your brain is forming, you're getting addicted to the alcohol, and it manifests much later in your life. And what I really appreciate about you having me on this show and others is that we're opening up the conversation, because, you know, addiction touches everyone. And so many of the treatment centers now are also having different programs to address different groups of people because their experiences are different. There are many first responder programs now. There are many programs specifically for nurses and doctors because they have a different relationship of trust to the public. There are many programs now for executives because, you know, if you have, if you're fortunate enough to have resources, it can be hard. You can deal with a lot of shame because you say, well, I have access to some of the finest treatments, and yet I'm still struggling, and you're comparing yourself to someone who is from one of those traumatic experiences, who is homeless, who may have had incredibly difficult experiences as children. They're two very different experiences of addiction, but both experiences require treatment. And so it's so important that we talk about it to take the shame out of addiction, and also for the people who are, you know, in public office and the people who are teachers and that, so that they feel that there is a place in the recovery community for them.
That's
so
difficult.
So thank you for having this conversation, you know,
yeah.
And the mothers, there's so many mothers. I mean, we hear so much of these conversation about the wine mothers, and it's become almost hip. But on the other side of the, oh, it's 4 o'clock, I'm having wine while I'm, you know, taking care of my child. There's some very serious consequences of that. And we have to be inclusive of all the people who need treatment and recovery.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a true pleasure having you back on. We could talk about this forever. You know, so I wrote a book too, because I think it's something intimate, and it's relationships. You know, that's a really hardcore thing, because your whole life is set up together, right? And some people may have a business, and then what you're saying about it's the people in the public eye too. Musicians go through it. I remember Stevie Nicks, when she's written about this, and that when she had to get off of cocaine and booze, she does have one shot of tequila every time she does a show, and that's it. And she stops at that. But she said when she first started, they were going back on tour with Fleetwood Mac, and she's like, I don't know if I can be around everything and actually be on stage without being high.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because it's like that was part of it. And I think there was that addiction part for musicians is, my God, I don't, you know, I can play music, but don't make me go up on stage, you know, or talk. Like when we did music, I could sing, but don't ask me to talk to the crowd, believe it or not. That's why I do radio. But anyway.
You do radio. Wow.
Yeah, I know. But
it's called pivoting.
It's interesting, but now I can talk anywhere. You know, obviously, I talk a lot. But she, it was Mick Fleetwood who said, just get on the bus, come sit next to me, and we're just going to go, and you're just going to do it. And, you know, you can always go home. And she just had to take that step. And once she got on the bus, she started looking at nature. She started writing. And she was also scared that your writing is going to be different, you know. So, you know, going through this process, you know, it's recovery is interesting because you are worried that you may not function as well as you did while, you know what I mean? You may not do your career.
And that's the false,
as well.
That's the false friend. It's the false friend, because there are so many programs now also for artists and recovery. And once they heal the initial, you know, trauma and detox and go through that process, their creativity isn't lost. Creativity is something that, that is within you. It is not because you drink or you do cocaine that you're creative. Your soul is creative. And so when you take away the darkness that comes with the substance, actually you can free yourself to be more creative. And we shouldn't be afraid that we will be different. I hope I continue to grow for the rest of my life. I hope that if we speak in another 4 years, I will be a different person, because that's the beauty of life, is we get to grow and change and experience. I don't want to be the same person.
See, that's what you did change.
When I have to go back to Uncle Bud, because when he finally took some steps to try, at first he was hard to handle, let's put it that way. Eventually, I believe he got it right, but it took more than one try, let's put it that way.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. It took me more than one try to ride my bike. I think that's totally fine.
Yeah, it takes more than one time sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, thank you so much again, everyone. The book is out now. Chantal Jovan. Jovan, did I get that right? Jovan?
You did.
I'm getting there.
It's easier to remember the title.
Yeah. Now, you know how I'm going to remember it? It's Coco Vaughn, whatever that cooking thing.
Oh.
that's
chicken Coco Vaughn.
I'm just going to remember that. Coco Vaughn. Chantal Jovan, Love Without Martinis, How Couples Build Healthy Relationships and Recovery Based on Real Stories. It's the real deal, everyone. You can go to ChantalJovan.com, and that's Chantal, ChantalJauvin, ChantalJovan.com. And we're going to play some music to close off the show. And I just feel like this is just one of those songs that just perfectly fits the conversation. This is called Life. It's by Josh Pfeiffer, an amazing singer-songwriter. It is off of his album, American Crooner, Act 1. And we're waiting for Act 2, Josh. And Josh is going to be performing again. He's got his first gig coming up this summer. Keep up with him at joshpfeiffer.com. Oh, he's so excited. You know, musicians get to go out and perform again. And I can't wait to see live music. Seriously.
Really?
Like,
me too.
Yeah, I know. Cycling, hiking, live music. Can we bring it all back, please? So anyway, here it is, Life. Thanks again so much, Chantal, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you as well.
Take care.
Here it is, Life. Take care.
Understand what my brother's going through. Oh, I hope when all is said and done that I haven't been a fool.
Did you miss out on Bitcoin? Did you miss out on Ethereum? I bet you did. Don't miss out on PulseX.com. I'm Richard Hart, and I'm the founder of Hex.com, whose price went up 10,000x in only 623 days. PulseX.com is launching now, and the rates start ramping up at 5% per day starting January 10th. You really don't want to be late. Go to PulseX.com right now, PulseX.com.
I'm here with Lawn of the Year winner, Jim. What's your secret?
Oh, well, there's no secret. It's True Green. You know they're America's number one lawn care company, don't you?
I did. And what did True Green do for you and your lawn?
Well, True Green's local experts came out. They did a complete lawn analysis, then put together an annual plan for my lawn. Plus, they offered me 50% off my first treatment.
For year-round expert lawn care and 50% off your first treatment, visit truegreen.com/RD today.